Hi and welcome. I'm Steve Martorano, and this is the Behavioral Corner. You're invited to hang with us as we discuss the ways we live today, the choices we make, the things we do, and how they affect our health and well-being. So you're on the corner, the Behavioral Corner. Please hang around a while.
Hey, everybody. How you doing? And welcome to the Behavioral Corner once again. You find me, your host and guide, Steve Martorano. On the corner. It's great being a host and guide to a show that pretends to be on a street corner because there's not much guiding that has to be done. We're here on the corner and we talk about everything that affects behavioral health, which is a big, big area to discuss. Behavioral health covers areas of choices that we make, the way we live, all of it affects our emotional, psychological, and spiritual well-being. So, that's what we do, and we hope it's catching on with you guys. Before I get to my guests, I just want to take a moment to remind you what really works for us, like really our lifeblood here, is feedback. So I just want to pause for a moment, remind folks, if you find us, the site's behavioralcorner.com. You can hear the podcast anywhere, particularly iTunes. If you write a review, that would be fantastic. And, you know, everyone likes to hear praise, but we're looking for honest evaluation of what we do, okay? Behavioralcorner.com, and that's where we are. All right, let's get to it because it's an important topic we're going to discuss on the corner today, and it has to do with policing in this country. I'm a child of the 60s. It's no stranger to me to see clashes or controversies or, you know, actual violence between police and the communities they serve, going back to the early days of the civil rights movement when I was very young, and certainly the anti-war movement and political turmoil back in the 60s brought all these up. Our cities in the 60s, as you all know, were often battlefields. And recently, of course, George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis has reminded us tragically once again that the divide that often exists between police and the communities they serve is almost always been with us and seems to be getting wider. I don't know. I hope not. But that's what we're going to talk about. Policing in this country and the challenges of that very, very difficult job. We're gonna do it here on the corner from the police perspective, from that side of it. But I dare say we'll get a perspective on both sides. But we wanted to go to the other side of the divide here and talk to an active police officer. Will Arletta has been a police officer for over a decade now, going on 12 years, 10 for the Stanford, Connecticut Police Department. And he joins us on the Behavioral Corner. Will, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're a youngin. I'm a little bit older than you, a little bit more than a little bit older than you. But you know the history of conflict in the cities of this country, and the police are always on the front line. What was it that attracted you to law enforcement?
Every time I'm asked this question, it always takes me back to my high school days. My father asked me what I wanted to be, what I wanted to do with my life. And I told him I wanted to be in some form of law enforcement, whether it be on a federal level with the FBI or an attorney or a police officer. And he scoffed at the idea of me being a police officer because in his eyes, he didn't feel like it was a professional enough job or career for somebody to go to college and then come and do. But once I actually decided to do it and I graduated from the police academy, he came down and saw, you know, they had a video of what we went through. They did a nice ceremony and all that. And he was blown away at how professional it really was. And it was the first time that I could see it in his face and his eyes that how proud he was of me. So it was back then I had what, if you could call it a calling, to law enforcement. It's something that I've always wanted to do. The biggest thing that attracted me to this job, this field, is the camaraderie aspect of the job. I'm big into sports. I played football in high school, and I wanted to be a part of something that I could be part of a team.
From start to finish, Will, how long did it take you to become a police officer?
It could take a few months to a couple of years just to get hired. Now, once you're hired, you're sworn in, you have to go through the initial application process. You have to do a written exam, a physical agility exam, and then a psychological exam. those are the parameters that you have to go through just to be sworn in. So sure. Once you're sworn in, you enter the police academy, and the police academy itself is 6 to 9 months of training in the police academy. I entered in February and graduated in July. So that was the time frame for me.
In July, you found yourself on the streets patrolling as an active duty police officer.
In July, I graduated from the police academy. Then, you know, you go to the police department and there's more training. I believe it's 12 weeks of field training. And you go through phase 1 through 4, and you're with a different police officer for each phase. By the time I was done with that whole process, it was over a year of training. I would say, maybe not a full year of training, but well, the training is never over. The training is ongoing. Like, I'm training still, you know, you have to do a specific amount of training every year, but the initial process from which you get hired, and then from the time you are done with FTO and you're fully a police officer on your own on the street, is just under a year.
That training obviously was valuable to you. What has changed over your career, the course of your career, where you thought the training lacked? In other words, you weren't prepared for some of these things because the training for it was lacking.
There is no training in existence that can prepare you for some of these situations that you're going to run into. The training is kind of a baseline for the minimum amount of professionalism, force, or what have you, necessary to be certified as a police officer. Now, once you're in there, there's a lot of gray and there's a lot of, you know, finagling you have to do to apply your training to a specific scenario.
We have a mental health crisis in this country. There are lots and lots of people who are not in institutions, not getting any treatment, often not taking the medicine if they've been prescribed medicine for serious psychiatric problems. When there's a problem with that, it almost invariably falls on the police to get there first. And as you just said, you get lots of training for lots of things, but maybe not that. And that's something that you confront an awful lot, right?
You're not just a police officer when you're dealing with someone like that, because some of the roles that you play as a police officer, sometimes you're a teacher, sometimes you're a psychologist, sometimes you're a parent. You know, in certain circumstances, when you're dealing with a child, a teen, an adult, an elderly person, depending on what the situation is, sometimes you play a different role.
Will, is that too much to ask of a police officer to be all those things?
I wouldn't say it's too much to ask. I think when you become a police officer, it's something that you should expect. You know, that there's going to be a lot asked of you to deal with the community. As a police officer, it's almost impossible to just play cops and robbers or, you know, doing traffic stops. There's a lot of, you're just playing the middleman to a civil dispute between neighbors. You know what I mean? And it has nothing to do with the actual law enforcement or any criminal activity. You're just trying to calm down an argument between two neighbors over leaves on somebody's property.
It's another irony of criticisms of the police that you can hear. And again, I'm not talking about the hardcore, you know, get rid of the police crowd. I'm talking about your garden variety complaints. And that is, as you say, a domestic dispute breaks out. Maybe there hasn't been any violence yet, but the neighbors are complaining about the noise. And so they call the police. And then the police get there. Maybe sometimes they're not prepared to handle that. And then the police get criticized for letting it get out of hand. Maybe somebody gets hurt. So do you agree or don't you agree that the community, as well as the media, certainly has to get a better handle on what they expect the police to do? You know, you see on the side of every police car to what? Serve and protect. Okay. And now you're talking about being a mother, you know, being a counselor, being a psychiatrist, being a referee. Do we expect too much from the police? Do you think the communities expect too much from the police?
I think in some aspects, yes. And in some aspects, no.
Yeah. And so that confusion, that tension, has led in many communities to a lack of trust. There's just a sense that police are almost a necessary evil. I think in some of our, you know, poorer neighborhoods, you know this better than anybody, where crime is very high, the people who live in their communities certainly don't want the police to go away. But that doesn't mean they trust them a whole lot. How can police and communities come together and build that trust?
I think the only way things will get better is for dialogue. And that means equal parts speaking and equal parts listening. You know, because if you have a lot to say and you're not listening, you're just venting and you're not really gaining anything from the interaction.
Yeah, the only interaction people have with police is during a crisis. And it's, you know, it's never about communication. It's about something bad's going on.
And that's very true. Like when the police are finally involved in whatever situation it is, you're typically dealing with a person who's probably having a rough time or the worst day of their life. You know what I mean? So you're there for a negative situation, you know, with fire and EMS, they're there to rescue. You're kind of feeling relieved when they're there on scene, like hurry up. They're waving you to please come help my mother. She's having a heart attack or whatever the case may be. But for us, we're not always welcomed in the situation.
And what's going on very often in very many communities in this country is that the police are no longer viewed by a large number of people, particularly communities of people of color, as a public servants to serve and protect, but as an occupying army. These are sort of people, they've got a lot of equipment, they got a lot of weapons. Our neighborhoods are sometimes scary. But when you show up, it's not reassuring. It's sort of, it almost adds to the threat of the lives they live. It's a tension-filled thing. Are police departments across the country facing a challenge here? How do they shift in that sort of militaristic attitude and get people to recognize you guys as servants?
Well, the thing I say about that is when you talk about the military, I don't think of them as something negative. To compare us to the military shouldn't be seen as something negative. I understand what you mean towards like, you know, seeing them as a little aggressive or intimidating. But, you know, with a lot of the things that we deal with, we could use that sense of force, our presence of being intimidating to our advantage. Because I'll use myself as an example. If I'm up to no good and I have the intention of committing a crime and I see what is described to be as a militaristic presence in front of me, I'm less likely to go through with that. In a sense, that's why we train hard. You're supposed to keep your physique up and do all those things. I think in many senses, just because you look a certain way doesn't mean that you can't be also a calming figure.
Calming is one thing. I would appreciate that. But intimidating is another. It certainly would intimidate me if police responded to something in my neighborhood with some of the stuff I've seen, you know, half tracks and SWAT teams with armor and helmets. And, that, you know, I understand that there are situations that call for that kind of response. But in general, I think it has driven a wedge at some of the communities who view you guys not as the cavalry coming to rescue, but this invading force. Listen, clearly it is not the entire truth, but certainly has contributed to the sense of dread about police and the amount of force.
And I think that there's just a lack of understanding when it comes to that, because when I'm wearing my uniform is necessary for my safety. If a vest, an outer carrier vest and my gun belt, and, you know, these are the things necessary for me to execute my job and at the same time for me to stay as safe as possible. Yes, there are situations where for crowd control, I may have to wear the heavy duty stuff with the helmet and the shield and things like that. But the situation dictates that level of force necessary.
I can certainly appreciate that. Well, as a police officer and obviously as a man of color, you saw George Floyd killed.
Yes.
As you watched that, what did you think of that?
It was shocking in nature. And the first thing I thought was, it's very difficult for someone to look at a police officer and differentiate between the good police officer and the bad police officer, because we're all wearing the same uniform. So when you see a man kill someone like that, you can't blame society for feeling that way, even though the statistics and the numbers prove opposite of what the society is saying about us right now. You know what I mean?
No, I don't. What do you mean?
Well, statistics show that more often than not, we're doing the job correctly, the way we're supposed to do it. There's very few bad apples within us, within the ranks of the police, that actually act out and do things like
that. Yeah, I agree with that completely.
But when you see something like that, you know, in these times with body cameras and cell phone cameras and things like that, it's hard for someone, just the average citizen, to see a police officer and not know, well, is he the good guy or the bad guy? Because they all wear the same uniform. It's going to be harder for people to trust us because we have a certain level of, you know, license to use force necessary for a specific situation. But are you going to be the police officer that uses excessive force? There's no way for an average person to differentiate that. They just have to be able to trust. And it's hard for them to trust after seeing something like that.
Well, absolutely. And the question is, can professional police forces afford even one bad apple? Well, this bad apple thing is not going down with a lot of people anymore. How can there be an apple that bad in a police department and not have people go, what's going on?
Unfortunately, you're right about that, but it's the reality of what we live in. The system isn't perfect. The hiring system, it's very rigid. In order for me to be in the position that I'm in, I've had to go through countless examinations, aptitude tests with the written tests, several verbal interviews with different members of the board and also the administration, psychological exam, psychiatric exam, a lie detector test. You know, all these officers have to go through that. It's not a fail-proof system, unfortunately. There are people that start off normal and competent people who, after a couple of years of being exposed to different things, they deal with certain traumas differently than other people.
So
it's not always that the person that you hired is a bad person.
Yeah.
They just become it. Hire a bad person, they just slip through the cracks.
Sometimes the wrong person is hired, but I don't think that's the problem. The problem is the job is stressful. It's one of the most difficult jobs we ask anybody to do. It's inconceivable to me that someone would, it's very difficult for me to understand the motivation for somebody like yourself who's willing to get up every day and go into the worst situations because I don't want to have to deal with them, but you do it. You pay a price for that. Police pay a price for that. I wonder if you think after 12 years as a professional law enforcement officer that you as, I don't mean you, but as a group, are getting the kind of support you need, psychological support. We know about suicide rates and drinking problems and divorce among police. The numbers are terrible. Do you think you guys are getting the kind of support you need for a very stressful job?
In the past, no. I think now with more research and I think people who have the power to implement these things, I think they're starting to see that it is very necessary to cater to some of the psychological mental health needs that we all need. With my town, my city, we have the peer group, which is a group of officers who are, you know, within the ranks, whether they are patrolmen, a sergeant, lieutenant, captain, they are part of the peer group who you can turn to. You can call them and let them know that you're having an issue and, you know, they can do their best to help you out. You can lean on them for emotional support, mental support. And also with that, you have the EAP, which is a service that's outside of department where you can get on the phone and call a psychologist and schedule someone and you could set up to meet with a therapist on a routine basis or just to go through what you're going through and help guide you with that. And,
yeah.
You know,
yeah, those EPAs are very, very important. And hopefully we have a generation of police officers who avail themselves of it. Because as you know, sometimes it's a question of, man up.
I was going to say that too. And it's not also that there's a lack of support from our administrations or the cities and the states that we work for, but it's also there's a sense from ourselves, like you should be able to handle this stuff.
Yeah.
You signed up to do this stuff. And, you know, there's a little bit of well, if I go in and call a therapist, then that means something is wrong with me. At the end of the day, you are a human being. And constantly being exposed to those traumas will have an impact on you. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but sometime down the line, it will.
Well, we talked a little bit about the bad apple, getting cops who wind up doing the wrong thing, sometimes with deadly consequences. Sometimes they're just bad cops and they don't hurt anybody, but they don't help anybody. Whenever a situation like that arises, almost more than any group in society that I can think of, there is a knee-jerk reaction to a perceived attack on police that results in what we refer to as the blue wall, circling the wagons, and protecting bad cops. Is that a problem?
Yes, it is, but I don't think that's the goal. The goal is when you put up the quote-unquote blue wall is to protect what you have, which is the law enforcement workforce. Because as a whole, we are a collective group of men and women who chose to do a job for many different reasons, for whether it be for the benefits or because you want to help people, or like myself, you want to be a part of a team atmosphere. You know, there's so many great men and women who do this job, and it goes without notice. But as soon as something bad happens, that's what's illuminated, and the spotlight is on that more so than the day-to-day. Because from, let's say, from the George Floyd situation till now, there are thousands and thousands of police interactions every day that you never hear about because they go right.
Yes, you're right. There are thousands and thousands of police interactions that we never hear of because nothing dramatic happens. But when someone dies, we do. Thousands of airplanes take off and land. We don't hear about those, but the one that crashes, we do. So the margin of error is narrow. I get that. Let me just ask a few more questions about this idea of not unwillingness, but hesitancy to weed out the bad cops in a public way. I understand that camaraderie, the unit matters. I get all that, but not at the expense of people potentially getting hurt. So you think police unions are part of the solution to the problem of policing and not part of the problem. Is that right?
What do you mean by that?
Are unions protecting bad cops, do you think?
No, I don't think so, because the way it's set up now is if you do something that violates somebody's constitutional rights and it's, you know, clear as day, you're not going to have the backing of a police department or a city. You're going to be on your own to defend yourself legally. If you violate the policies and procedures of your police department and also the state, what they legislate for us to do, they're not going to fight you.
And it's always been that. And you're on your own.
And it's always been that way. It's not something new.
Mm-hmm. What are you hopeful about going forward?
It's difficult because it is a difficult time to be a police officer. And I see the new recruits that come in, and I'm happy to see that, you know, somebody is willing to come in to this career field during these times. But at the same time, I also think, man, you're going to have it tough, kid. But what I hope for is that things just get better, you know, that there's more of a understanding, more of a healing between the community and police, because obviously there's a disconnect there. So I hope that, and I honestly believe that with time, you will start to see more and more what we really are about and what it is that we do. And hopefully, you know, members of the community, as you see crime is rising right now, they'll, you know, I understand that you see us as a necessary evil, but I hope that you know, with time that you could see that we're not evil. We're just a necessary part of society.
Yeah. Well, the police have to be part of the solution.
Yes, absolutely.
They have to be part of the solution. They cannot be part of the problem. And you're right. The community and the police have a responsibility to make sure that happens, that police solve our problems.
And to further that, the police and the community isn't two separate things in a lot. We are members of the community as well. We want to see, you know, good cops doing the right things every day, because we're also husbands, wives, daughters, sons, cousins, you know, grandparents. We're in the schools. Our kids go to the same schools as other people, and we're in churches, and we're part of the community. So, yeah, of course, we want to be part of the solution.
It's great to remind people of that, because they think of you guys and you women as those people in the uniforms with the guns and the batons, and you're way more than that. Will Arletta, we want to talk more about this going forward. We hope we can have you and maybe some of your fellow officers join us from time to time, because as I said, there are problems for sure, but it's not an easy job. And anybody who thinks it is kidding themselves. You know, you're to be congratulated for your service, obviously. And thanks for joining us on the corner. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Studies show that 2020 has negatively affected the mental health of millions of Americans. That is why at Retreat, we work to provide comprehensive mental health programming through our Synergy Health programs. To learn more about Synergy and the comprehensive mental and behavioral health services we offer, call us today at 855-802-6600.
That's it for now. And make us a habit, hanging out at the Behavioral Corner. And when we're not hanging, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter on the Behavioral Corner.